Sayadaw, dear listeners, Professor Venkatraman is now ready with his fifth talk in the current series, and it is titled Man vs. Machines. Professor has prepared this talk in a hurry, and frankly, I have no clue of what he is going to talk about. So, why don't I just hand you over and sit back to listen what Professor Venkatraman is going to say. Over to the professor.
Sairam, dear listeners, and greetings from Prashanti Nilayam. As just announced, this is my fifth talk in the continuing series relating to the relevance of moral values in the current globalized age. And the topic I have chosen for today is Man versus Machines. As you would realize later, this is a very serious topic that needs some discussion. But first, let me set the stage for what is to follow. I am sure it's no news to seniors like me that steady jobs have now become a thing of the past. Except for those in the public sector, and in India that's a very large number, most people these days drift from one job to another and even become jobless. In fact, this is no longer a rare and unusual experience. And nowhere is this job loss more serious than in America, and some of you who tuned into my previous talk might recall my making reference to this worrisome development. Now, in this talk, I am going to focus on what might be called the very root of the problem I just referred to. For specificity, I shall start by focusing on America, where the problem first surfaced as a cost of manufacture issue. Now, prior to 1970, if one went to a department store in America to buy dress, appliances, and so forth, one would find that most of those things were made in America. Back then, America had a very big manufacturing base, which not only kept its shopping malls full, but also provided tens of millions of jobs to the American labor force. That's the point you have to note. For example, the auto industry in America was an entire ecosystem in itself. Steel for cars were made in America. Aluminium, which is very much needed in cars, was made in America. So were all the ancillaries, the brakes, the seats, the seat covers, the tires, and so on. The list is long. To cut a long story short, manufacture not only contributed significantly to the national wealth of America, but also provided a steady monthly income to tens of millions of American citizens. In fact, back then it used to be said, what's good for General Motors is good for America. That summed it all at that time. With the advent around 1970 of the free market philosophy, I made a reference to this in my last talk, America rapidly switched from a manufacturing economy to a consumerist economy. Now, in a consumerist system, people made money by selling as many things as possible to as many people as possible and at the lowest price they could offer. There is, of course, a lot more to the story, but skipping all that, the moment American manufacturers learned that made in America products could no longer compete in their consumerist economy, they quietly shipped lock, stock and barrel most of their manufacturing base overseas. Now, it so happened that around the same time, China had decided to pull out of poverty millions of its poor people living in rural areas. And how did they do it? By offering them with industrial jobs that paid much better than rural jobs did. As soon as China mounted this social uplift thrust, that country became the favored destination for American manufacture. Thanks to the much lower wages in China, the various goods needed by the American consumerist market could now be made in China and at a much lower cost. In other words, American consumers could now buy made-in-China consumer goods at dream prices. On the other hand, although the consumerist economy gained a lot, it nearly wiped out most of the American manufacturing base. Not only did most of the steel plants in America shut down, but so did a whole lot of other manufacturing industries. Thus, brand-name shoes, once made in America and were eagerly sought, now had to be imported from China. The same happened to dress, home tools, garden implements, and thousands of other items. You name it, it is all made in China, 90% at least. To put it simply, with the advent of consumerism in America, most of its original manufacturing base, which was the pride of the country, was rapidly hollowed out. One might say, okay, manufacturing costs were very low in China, but what about the cost of shipping all those products made in China to America? That exactly is where two interesting factors separately entered the picture in support of American consumerist economy. Firstly, back then the price of oil was very low. In fact, by today's standards, it was ridiculously low. And that low price also kept shipping costs very low. Added to that, technology soon came up with giant container ships. I hope you have seen them at least in pictures. And these ships drastically reduced shipping costs even further. You see how various aspects often reinforced each other to promote both mass production as well as mass consumption? Well, the net outcome of all this was that while those in America who sold goods made tons of money, those who earlier used to make those goods in America now lost their jobs. This job loss process, which started as a trickle, soon became a serious national issue because it also produced a serious income inequality. Please keep that background in mind as I now take you to a meeting that President Obama had with Steve Jobs in the White House about 5 or 6 years ago. For this record, it was late Steve Jobs who literally changed the way people around the world communicated with each other using his famous iPhone. I don't have to explain what the iPhone is because it's well known even around here. The iPhone was designed entirely in America, with Steve Jobs being personally involved with all the aspects of products development, including the aesthetics of the phone. But when it came to manufacture of hundreds of millions of iPhones, Steve Jobs outsourced the entire task to China, and that one single decision created over 100,000 jobs in China instead of in America. Do you get my point? Deeply concerned about the massive flight of manufacturing jobs, President Obama asked, "Steve, is there any way we can bring those lost manufacturing jobs back to America?" Steve's terse reply was, "Forget it, Mr. President. Those jobs ain't coming back. Never." Presently, the situation has become even worse thanks to many new developments. Now, the latter is a long story, but in brief, there are at least two parts to it. One, during the last few decades, machines are being increasingly connected to computers, with the result that an entire plant can now be run with just a few operators who know how to program the machine. This new advance in technology is called computer-aided manufacture. Many American manufacturers decided to follow this route to keep cost of production low by letting machines do most of the work that shop floor workers did earlier. Two, thanks to a sharp rise in the production of oil and natural gas in America, the cost of electricity sharply declined, and that provided an additional bonus for those starting machine-assisted manufacture in America. Now, to make matters even worse, all of the above was followed by the entry of smart computers, that made manufacture considerably more efficient via robotic control. Thanks to that, an entire factory could now be run without any human presence on the floor. You see how manufacturing was being revolutionized slowly but inevitably. First, there were no computers. Then came computer-aided manufacture. And this was followed by totally computer-controlled manufacturing. The fight between man and machine became even worse with the entry of a new villain named artificial intelligence, or AI for short. AI is all about extremely clever software that enables computers to think, rapidly improve its intelligence, and even become inventive. In other words, computers now literally became not only a threat to human livelihood, but even humans' relevance in society, except possibly as a computer. Unruffled by all this, computer scientists became excited and actively promoted research in AI, to which they gave the name machine learning. This is a way of hiding the truth, fancy names. Obviously, these computer scientists claimed how useful AI can be and all that. That's standard propaganda. Yes, AI has been beneficial in many ways, especially where disease treatment is concerned. But it has also substantially aggravated the job loss situation. What is worse, and this is important, AI also has the potentiality of leading to highly dangerous and totally unintended consequences. Mercifully, several top scientists have sounded a strong warning that research in AI must be strictly and properly regulated so that the unintended consequences mentioned above are avoided. Stephen Hawking, who triggered my last talk, has specifically warned, and I quote, "It," meaning a robot with AI, "it would take off on its own and redesign itself at an ever-increasing rate. Humans, who are limited by slow biological evolution, couldn't compete with these self-designing robots and would be superseded." For the record, I must state that some months ago, a group of eminent scientists, Stephen Hawking included, wrote an open letter to society arguing for strict regulation of research in AI. Presently, that open letter has been signed by thousands of people, maybe more than 10,000 or 100,000. Now, scientific research in most countries is largely paid for the taxpayers, and it is they, the taxpayers, who must step in and regulate research in AI to prevent researchers from running away with wild research schemes that may lead to unforeseen disaster. You see, I'm not talking through my head. Till now, the possibility of scientists accidentally creating a monster like Frankenstein was in the realm of science fiction and horror movies. But now, as Stephen Hawking warns, AI could actually create a robot that behaves like a monster. Keep that background in mind as I now turn to the topic of the day, namely man versus machine. It is amazing, at least I find it so, that almost 100 years ago, Mahatma Gandhi clearly foresaw what is happening presently, and he actually warned humanity about it. Initially, Gandhiji was totally against machines because textile mills in England were making dhotis for sale in India and driving out small handloom weavers in this country. That is why he adopted the charkha as a symbol of how India once made its own yarn and later used that yarn to make clothes. But after a while, Gandhi slightly mellowed and softened his stand on machines to say the following, quote, "I do visualize electricity, shipbuilding, ironworks, machine making and the like existing side by side with village handicrafts. Hitherto, industrialization has been so planned as to destroy the village and village handicrafts. In the state of the future, industrialization will subserve the villages and their craft. You see from this that Gandhi did accept that industrialization had its benefits, but at the same time, he did not want it to overwhelm the poor. I must point out that Gandhi did not see machines merely as a threat to the livelihood of ordinary people. Instead, he also saw the issue of man versus machine in a larger context, spiritual and philosophical, and the purpose of human life, and how one should spiritually elevate oneself via simple living and high thinking. Listen to what he says, quote, "The mind is a restless bird. The more it gets, the more it wants, and still remains unsatisfied. Therefore, the idea of creating an unlimited number of wants and satisfying them seems to be a delusion and a snare. Civilization, in the real sense, consists not in the multiplication of wants, but in the deliberate and voluntary reduction of wants." That's what Swami also said. Gandhi says, I do not believe that multiplication of wants and machinery contrived to supply them is taking the world a step nearer to its goal. I wholeheartedly detest this mad desire to destroy distance and time, to increase animal appetites, and to go to the end of the earth in search of their satisfaction. If modern civilization stands for all this, and I have understood it to be so, I call it satanic. That is really great. What a foresight. Yes, I personally find it amazing that Mahatma was able to foresee the future long, long before the advent of the consumerist way of life, the iPhone, etc. And what would happen if the mind is left free to run away wildly as it pleases? Allow me at this stage to pause briefly and do a quick recap of the themes I have covered in my four earlier talks. The first one, titled "The Dangers of a Runaway Mind," sounded a cautionary note about not allowing the mind to come up with pointless technological and scientific adventures. In my second talk, I discuss what happens when man and money come together in an unholy and totally unprincipled coalition. My third talk was devoted to man-made climate change, how things have almost reached a tipping point, how endless human desire has produced this dangerous situation, and finally why ceiling on desires is the urgent need of the hour. The fourth talk, which was my most recent one, was based on a statement released recently by Stephen Hawking, who has pointed out how the sharp increase in economic inequity has finally forced the forgotten many to express their anger, and why everyone has a moral responsibility to give back to society, at least something in return for society has given to them. In his inaugural address as the President of the United States, that was way back in 62, I believe, President Kennedy famously said, "Ask not what America can do for you, instead ask what you can do for America." Swami went even further. And on many occasions, he emphatically told students, especially on convocation day, "You are what you are solely because of society. You therefore have an imperative duty to give back to society all you can, placing its needs above those of yourself." Coming to my present talk, let me quote what Gandhiji wrote in 1988 in the magazine Harijan, which he established. He says, and I quote, "The whole gamut of man's activities today constitutes an indivisible whole. You cannot divide social, economic, political, purely religious work into watertight compartments. I don't know of any religion apart from human activity." End of quote. You know what? Swami said the same thing. Life is a continuous chain of actions. Even when we sleep, the heart is pumping, the lungs are breathing, the blood is circulating, the stomach is digesting, and so on. Remember that sloka, Aham Vaishvanaro Bhutva? What is particularly important are the actions we perform, when we are awake and have full knowledge of what we are doing. Knowing Gandhi's passion for the Gita, I would venture to say that what the Mahatma means in the quote offered above is that every one of our actions must always be in harmony with Dharma. In spite of this, the myth has emerged that moral values have become irrelevant in the globalized age. A famous American politician once said, "Everyone is entitled to his own views and opinions, but no one is entitled to his own facts." In the same way, I would venture to say, people can dismiss foundational moral values all they want, but no one can escape the consequences. By the way, Gandhi said that also way back in 1931. There is little that escaped the Mahatma's notice where matters spiritual were concerned. It is no wonder that Einstein said of him later, after the Mahatma passed away, "Generations to come would scarce believe that such a one as this, ever in flesh, walked upon the earth." Well, my time is up and I take your leave with an apology for the slight irregularity of this series, which is due to circumstances beyond my control. However, I give you the assurance that after my next talk, which, by the way, would be dealing with science and spirituality, I would shift my focus entirely to what Swami has said and taught us regarding the foundational and absolute nature of moral values. With or without globalization, moral values have been and shall always remain the very basis of life and the way it is lived. At least that is my view, and it rests on the teachings of Rama, Krishna and Swami. My point is simple. If it was good for the three authors, it is also good for me. That's the way I see it. Anyway, you can think about it and let me know if you disagree. Goodbye. Wishing all of you a good 2017. And by the way, it is supposed to be a prime number. I don't know whether it's correct. Jai Sai Ram.
Sai Ram, dear listener. That concludes Professor Venkatraman's fifth talk in his current series. We hope you found the talk interesting and useful. Do write back to us with your comments and observations, as always, to listener@radiosai.org. Thank you for listening and giving Radio Sai the privilege of serving you.